Okay, yes, we know about the drought. And how thankful are people right now that we got this? Well, it started out as $1 million rain. And then I heard Jim Brown talk about it yesterday. He's our Commissioner of Securities and Insurance on the program yesterday. He said it's $1 billion rain. And I think that's really true. But we are still expecting to be pretty dry this summer. Hopefully that's not the case. And when wildfire season hits, there are things that we want to put in place, right? We think about that. We think about energy, the power lines, the thunderstorms, and things like that. What are we doing for fire safety? How do we keep the energy going during those kinds of things? And then if you see something that has you kind of a little concerned, who do you call? We're going to have Max Rebels on the program here. I told you, Max, I was going to do that. He's Wildfire Public Information Manager at Northwestern Energy. And a bit later on, Ryan Hall is going to join us as well. He's with the Montana Electric Cooperative Association. Got fire safety on our minds here as well. A bit later on, we're going to talk about data centers, too, because Ryan with Mecca just visited one. So that's on our plate. Let's just welcome our guests and get right into these issues here. Max Rebels is with us. Rebels. I know I'm getting it wrong, Max. What's wrong with me? I'm going to call you Max the Rebel. Will that work?
That works. Yeah. It works. Absolutely.
I like that. It's Max Rebels, though. R-E-B-H-O-L-Z, Wildfire Public Information Manager at Northwestern Energy. Boy, you know, Max, you were probably thinking you were going to have a fairly busy season. How are you guys now, feeling about this rain?
Yeah, the rain is definitely welcomed. Obviously the winter didn't have the snowpack they were quite hoping for, but soils are staying pretty moist going into the peak fire season months. We'll see. I mean, if we continue to get these little shots of rain throughout the summer months, we could be sitting pretty good. Last year we were predicting a pretty intense fire season, but we had those consistent shots of rain throughout the months of June, July, into August. So we're hoping the same continues for 2026.
What, do you guys have like different protocols? Or maybe it's all the same. I don't know. But when you see a dry spring or a dry winter, and we have to talk about mitigation efforts and, get us a better understanding of what you do there as well. But does that signal different protocols for Northwestern Energy down the road?
Yeah, it does. I mean, so we use a dashboard that predicts and gives a forecast for what the wildfire risk index will be like for that upcoming week. If it's forecasted dry, hot, windy conditions, we can adjust the settings on the power lines to be more reactive to potential faults. So, for example, on like a normal, windy day when fire risk is not high, you'll notice, say your lights will be flickering on and off. I'm sure we've all experienced that to some extent. That's essentially the system just trying to clear a fault on its own. So say a branch, tree branch contacting the line. One might experience their lights inside flickering on and off. And that flickering is due to the system trying to automatically clear that fault. So when we get into higher fire risk days and conditions, we don't want that system. We don't want our system to try to automatically clear that fault because that branch, for example, could serve as an ignition source.
Yeah.
So what we'll do is we'll tell the system to not automatically clear the fault and to shut off power immediately to prevent causing a fire. And so we call these enhanced power line safety settings. And we'll employ those or enable those most often, during the more peak fire season months, or even, instances where it's really dry in November or, early spring before greenup occurs. We'll turn those settings on or off depending on the day, what the forecasted fire conditions are. So, like I said, in normal circumstances, what will happen is, the system will try to clear the fault on its own. But on those high fire risk days, rather than clearing the fault, the power will just be, automatically cut off, essentially. So an outage would occur. And then we'll send out a crew to go out there and inspect the line where the fault occurred, where that outage occurred. Make repairs if needed, or just give an all clear to make sure that it's safe to turn back power without causing, a fire or B, more damage. Those enhanced power line safety settings is one thing that we'll do to adjust the settings or adjust the system based on the forecasted fire risk conditions. And then, as a last resort measure, another thing that we'll do is a public safety power shutoff, which is more of a proactive step that we'll take. And it's a last resort effort, like I said, but that is, on those forecasted hot, windy days before the weather event arrives, a few hours before the weather event arrives, we'll actually just proactively turn off power to those certain high fire risk areas to prevent or eliminate the ignition of a fire. So those enhanced power line safety settings, it's more of a reactive outage, and outages in those scenarios, people might experience a few hours, whereas the public safety power shutoff, that could last from a few hours to potentially a day or more, multiple days. That's wow. Really determined based on the extent of damage that's sustained or how long the wind event is forecasted to last.
Yeah, Max Rebel, Rebels is with us. He's a wildfire public information manager at Northwestern Energy. Knows a little bit about this as well. Missoula County Office of Emergency Management was there for a little while. Public information officer as well on a number of hazard events. Max, I'm already learning stuff I didn't know really about this. And I'm just kind of curious, but also glad to hear that tech is employed in so many places when it comes to fire safety. I think we think that there's power lines, people will put up power lines, and then while they're out in the wild, we'll just leave them alone, they should be okay. And I know we've seen some incidents over the years that has created some questions, some liability concerns and all that. We'll probably address that a little bit more here in a little bit with Ryan Hall with Mecca a bit later on. But tell me more about this tech. Tell me more about when these things kind of came about. Tell me more about, and then we'll get into some of the protocols regarding the shutoff. But what's exciting, in tech when it comes to fire safety?
Yeah, so I think one of the more interesting pieces of tech that we'll employ or deploy out in the field are these wildfire detection cameras. It's like an advanced lookout. You can think of a person, an individual, being stationed at a Forest Service lookout tower back in, the early 1900s and the 60s and 70s. And they're still around today, but, those will be the fire spotters, if you will. But now with this advanced technology, we'll go out and purchase these wildfire detection cameras, and we'll place them on top of ridgetops, usually on a cell tower site. Or we'll put them on, power poles, for example. And so what they do is they use AI to decipher what's between smoke or what's dust on the road or clouds in the sky. And they can detect a smoke column. And then when that happens, an alert gets sent to the camera company's dispatch center, and then a human, on their end verifies it and then sends out an alert to Northwestern employees or to various dispatch centers, like Wildland Fire Agency dispatch centers or, county level dispatch centers, fire chiefs, emergency managers, basically who's ever needs to know about that smoke column and those that would have jurisdiction with responding to that smoke event. So they've been a really useful tool. They're deployed in 15 different states, and they've detected well over 6,000 fires. And they're really advantageous because for effective suppression of fires, you need rapid detection and rapid suppression. So that early detection leads to that early suppression, which keeps the fire small, so you have less of an impact on the natural resources. And then you also have less suppression costs as well when you keep those fires small. So they've been hugely advantageous for us as well as for our agency partners in keeping that fire small. And we have about 20 of them deployed right now. We're going to do another 20 this year. So we'll have, 40 across the state. And even, outside of just that, initial fire detection, they're really useful for us in understanding, what the current conditions are. So, if we're based out of Helena or Butte or Bozeman, for example, we can zoom out to, Billings area or, Great Falls area and look at what the conditions are like on the ground on that day. And it really gives us good, situational awareness of what the fuel conditions are.
Yeah. excuse me. I appreciate that because you can't take anything for granted when you're out there on a fire or trying to prevent fire as well. And so there's a lot of diligence in this. I got a breakup coming here, but a couple of minutes before that, let's get into the topic about mitigation because, I know that there are some required mitigation efforts as well. There's some preferred, recommended stuff that, that the public can do as well. But mitigation, it involves a lot of things, right? I think you guys were putting up stronger poles, upgrading equipment, burying some lines, things like that. What is mitigation, fire mitigation in 2026, Max?
Yeah, so, I mean, generally speaking, I think wildfire mitigation is really just, the ongoing effort to, reduce the risk and impacts of wildfires on people, on property, on infrastructure, and on natural resources. So, yeah, like you said, it involves actions taken by not only utilities, but land management agencies, local governments, communities, and then down to, individual homeowners and businesses. So we can create, more fire-resilient landscapes and fire-adaptive communities. So it's really those collective actions that will lead to a community that's better equipped or adapted to take fire as part of a, natural resource process. Like you mentioned, some of the things that we do on the utility side of it is, we'll address degrading poles. We'll do pole replacements. So we'll install taller, stronger, more resilient poles, poles that will, be taller than trees, for example. So we avoid those tree contacts as being one. We'll install stronger line that's more resilient. Like I said, with the poles, we'll install more poles. So we'll have additional poles set in place to reduce the chances of lines contacting each other in high wind events. And then, another kind of more obvious one is burying power lines when it makes sense to do so. We'll underground power lines as well. So, those are just some of the few actions that we'll take on the utility side, along with, another obvious one is managing our vegetation, make sure we reduce those tree conflicts, reduce the vegetation that's accumulating in the right-of-ways, and then work with our land management agency partners to hopefully expand on those right-of-way treatments so we have more of a fuel break established between our power line and the surrounding the land, essentially.
Yeah, and that's something that is always recommended in the urban interface for the public as well. And so more than 85%, this is a statistic that kind of astounds me a little bit, but maybe not. But there's good news and bad news in that. More than 85% of U.S. wildfires are caused by human activity. What does that tell you? That tells you we can be a little bit lackadaisical with fire, but it also tells you that we can do an awful lot about reducing fire as well. Fire is just so dramatically impactful in communities. I mean, Max and I were chatting here. Max Rebels is with us. He's with Northwestern Energy as the Wildfire Public Information Manager as well. More to talk about here too, but the Maui Fire, Colorado, California, you got to have water to put out fires that big. And then we even mentioned Denton, Montana too. And so it can happen. There's a lot of things, and they are weather, can often be weather caused, but 85% caused by human activity. So there's good news and bad news in that. Welcome back to Voices of Montana. Tom Schultz alongside Ryan Hall will join us a bit later on. We'll get on some data center information with him. He's communications manager for the Montana Electric Cooperatives Association, but we'll also talk about fire safety from their standpoint. Northwestern Energy puts on a fire safety summit on a yearly basis. And Max is just fresh off of that, as is, was Ryan Hall as well. And Max, I got a few things I want to put on the plate here too, but let's, you know, since I started off with that statistic, let's start off with what customers can do. You know, what do you recommend? We're seeing more and more development deeper into our rural areas, so to speak. And if 85% of wildfires are caused by human activity, we can do an awful lot in reducing wildfire, but just being smart about it, I suppose.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think some of the big ones are, you know, prevention and mitigation. You know, those are two separate buckets, how I look at them and how a lot of people look at those. So, you know, if you're a wildland urban interface landowner, or any really landowner for that matter, you know, just making sure that, you know, you're not burning debris on, you know, hot, dry, windy days. You know, using, you know, your local county burn permit system and adhering to the days in which you can and can't burn, and just other things like being smart with, you know, fires, your campfire, you know, double checking your trailer chains, things like that. But then also taking mitigation actions around your home and property. There's, you know, very well-founded and well-grounded science in different steps that you can take to prepare your home and property for wildfire. By, you know, working within the home ignition zone is a big one. So the home ignition zone is your house and about 100-foot area around it. And really the steps that you need to take are really focused on that first 5 feet around the house is really critical to preventing, you know, structure loss from wildland fire. So making sure that, you know, you don't have any combustible material or debris or vegetation within that first 5 feet around the house. And doing things like home hardening, you know, replacing siding if possible. That can be an expensive one, obviously, and you know, replacing wood shake roofs with metal roofs or asphalt roofs. So even screening in crawl spaces and vents. You know, most vents on homes are screened with 1/4-inch screen or even larger in some instances. And so replacing that screen with 1/8-inch vent with 1/8-inch screening over those vents is really important to do. That 1/8-inch screening, you know, when embers contact homes, that really knocks down the embers to be so small that they don't have enough heat content to ignite what's actually on the other side of those vents, whether that's, you know, debris under a deck or that's, you know, insulation or cardboard boxes on the other side of your attic. So different things like that. And then also preparing for, you know, power outages in the summer months is a big one too. So, we have a whole list of things that folks can do on our website to prepare for those extended outages. But, you know, some of the major ones are sign up for alerts through northwestern.com, sign up for outage alerts, and also making sure that your contact information is up to date. So if you're a Northwestern customer, you log into your energy account and just double check or ensure that you have the right contact information up to date, so the right phone number and email. So when we do a public safety power shutoff, you can stay properly informed. We'll send out text messages and emails and phone calls. We'll try to do that at least, 2 days in advance of a public safety power shutoff, if we have the time to do so. We'll send out those text messages and emails and calls 2 days in advance and update our website with the information of what's going on with that public safety power shutoff. But then that's really more of to give residents and businesses and communities time to prepare. So, you know, think about, you know, a lot of our water is, you know, able to be used based off electricity, right? So just stocking up on water, making sure that you put a freezer block or an ice block in your freezer, limiting the amount of times you open and close the freezer and fridge. And another really good idea is to invest or, you know, look into getting a backup power source, whether it's a generator or a battery-powered backup source for your house. Those battery ones are nice because you can operate them inside. Obviously, the generator, you don't want to operate that inside a house, but those battery-powered ones are nice as long as they're charged ahead of time. You can, depending on the model, you can keep a fridge running on those, or, you know, if you have some other kind of critical medical device, say like a wheelchair or a CPAP machine, et cetera, you can keep those running through a power outage as those could be more likely to occur now in the summer months.
Yeah, I want to talk about those protocols. You're kind of getting into it here. Again, Max Rebholz with us, Wildfire Public Information Manager at Northwestern Energy. So essentially for, you know, what customers can do, there are some good suggestions in there and some things I don't always think about or things I would take for granted. But if there's a little bell that's going off in your head about, hey, this might be a fire hazard, pay attention to that. Because a lot of it is common sense. What are some of those protocols that go into your 48-hour notice regarding a public safety power shutoff?
Yeah, so some of the protocols that go in. So we have a wildfire risk dashboard that tracks the 7-day forecasts every week, 365 days a year. And it will track things like, you know, the dryness of the vegetation, the wind speed, the humidity, the temperatures, et cetera. So we'll look at that. And this dashboard that we use will recommend we do these enhanced power line safety settings, which is like those kind of more reactive based outages that could occur, mm-hmm. or it could recommend a public safety power shutoff. So the elements that go into that are hot temperatures, dry vegetation, low humidity, and high wind. And really, the wind is like the big one for the public safety power shutoffs. Extremely windy days extremely windy, hot, dry, and low humidity days are, you know, the days that we would consider doing a public safety power shutoff. And then we look at where those conditions are set to occur. So they're occurring in an area where we have, you know, strong asset health. You know, maybe we did some mitigation work in that area, like that could be, you know, installing better poles, or that could be, you know, installing stronger conductor, different things like that. We look at where that wind event is happening. And then we also look at what's the customer impact as well. You know, what type of services and businesses or homes, for example, would be impacted by a public safety power shutoff, as well as what other sort of infrastructure could be impacted by that. So those are some of the elements that we look into. And when we see those conditions line up and impacting a certain area of the state of Montana, we'll send out a notice to customers automatically 2 days before. We'll try to do it 2 days before we plan to shut off power. So we'll send out those automated texts, emails, phone calls. As long as we have a customer's current information, we can send out those notifications.
Yeah.
That's... We try to do that 2 days before, but, you know, as we know, weather in Montana is very dynamic. So there could be instances where they might send it a day before or even a few hours before.
Max, I learned a ton today. Thank you so much for coming on and doing that. And I probably have a few more questions, but we got Ryan Hall up next as well, who attended your Wildfire Safety Summit as well from Mecca. So that's really cool. Max Rebholz again with Northwestern Energy. Good job, Max. Have a safe summer, okay?
All right. Yep. Thank you, Tom.
All right. See you later. I was told this was a dad joke pun, but we're talking fire safety today. It's not the hot topic that data centers are. Did you get that? See what they did there? But it is very important. We'll get the data centers here, too, because Ryan Hall, who is with us now, Communications Director, Montana Electric Cooperatives Association, mtco-ops.com, for more information, fresh off of a tour of a data center. But I want to get on to some fire safety as well and see what the co-ops are doing there, too, because, you know, they were key components of or key supporters of a bill, HB 490, I think it was, that took care of some questions out there regarding liability, but also require the co-ops to put together a wildfire management plan. I wonder how that's going. I wonder how Ryan Hall is doing. How you doing, sir?
Doing good. How you doing, Tom?
Hanging in there. Really happy, you know, for the range. You guys, I know you guys got your share in Great Falls too, right?
Yeah, we did. My kids play soccer and they've been soaked a few times on weekends and we can't even complain.
Yeah, I know. That's good. Hey, thanks for coming on. Appreciate that. I'm curious. I know that HB 490 again, as I said, going in there, you guys put a lot of effort behind that. Do most of those co-ops now, are those wildfire mitigation plans coming into place, or is there a deadline for those to be approved, or do they have to be approved? What's the process there?
So it's a little different with electric cooperatives. As you know, we're kind of self-governed by our boards. Mm-hmm. We always like to say, if you've seen one co-op, you've seen one co-op. So each board approved their own co-ops plan. But yes, they all had to be in place by the end of last year. So all of our 25 co-ops across the state have a wildfire mitigation plan that's been approved by their board and has been in action now for several months.
Yeah, what goes into those?
It's a lot of different things. The main thing is vegetation management. So making sure that there's a program that trims back trees before they become a problem. Try and keep them out of the right-of-way, trees that could fall into the right-of-way onto lines. Trim those up, those type of things. Flathead Electric and Missoula Electric have had very robust programs for years, so they've got a very good model for us to look at. And then things that people may not think of, I know you're probably familiar with them, but reclosers that normally, if you feel like a blink at your house but the power comes back on, something tapped the line and a recloser will open and close three times before it shuts off the power. But each time a little tiny spark could be released, and that's a problem in the summer. So a lot of our co-ops change those reclosers from what we call three shot to one shot, which means there's less chance of sparking a wildfire, but you may have a little longer outage because it has to go and be manually reset in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I get that too. And I think we've learned, right? And why don't you talk about that, about those lessons? The Denton fire was one thing I think that, again, as I talk about, that was naturally caused, so to speak. But there were things that could have mitigated that fire a little bit as well. You guys are always learning, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously the Denton fire wasn't, you know, right on ours. But, yeah, mm-hmm. Things we're always learning. I mean, California had lessons. Hawaii had lessons. Yeah. There's things you're always learning. There's industry practices. We meet with our friends at Northwestern and MDU at least once a month and chat about things. We have our National Rural Electric Co-ops Association, and Mark goes to RESMA, which is the managers group. I go to communication Zooms and meetings, and we're always sharing information. So even if something happens in North Carolina that we can learn from, we get that information, that input, and if something happens out here, they learn from us. So we're always looking for new best practices and for what happened elsewhere that we can kind of insulate against the best we can in Montana.
Yeah, when it comes to fire safety, we're all more so on the same page than fighting against each other like some of these other issues. Ryan Hall with us again, Montana Electric Cooperatives Association. Do you guys have a public safety power shutoff protocol?
So right now we only have one electric co-op that has the PSPS, and that is Northern Lights, which is actually based up in Idaho, close to Sandpoint, Sagal, Idaho, and they do come into just the western side of Montana. Mm-hmm. They're the only ones that have it at this point. There's been discussions. There's talks about it. Again, you say we're always learning. We're watching to see how it works with our friends who are trying that and seeing how that works, how it affects customers, how it affects the wildfire risk, all those type of things. So it's something we're watching, but as of right now, only one co-op has instituted it, to my knowledge. I mean, there's 25. I can always be off, but I believe that's the only one.
You know, and you guys, again, like you say, when you say see one co-op, you've seen one co-op, you guys have to collaborate an awful lot, I think. And that's one of the beauties of your association, the Montana Electric Cooperatives Association. It provides a platform for that. But it's not just between co-ops. It's also with fire safety officials in every local community. So, you know, maybe talk about that collaboration. Talk about what goes into that. And then, you know, it's going to be different coming out of that from Western Montana to Eastern Montana.
Oh, absolutely. It's really nice for us. Like I said before, we have local boards and our employees are members of the co-op in many cases. And so the nice part there is our linemen, our board members, they tend to be volunteer firefighters. They tend to be the EMT group. So it's a real easy collaboration and working relationship there because there's some crossover. And because we're in each community and not, one organization that's statewide, it's really easy for each co-op to figure out the best way to work with their fire departments. You know, some of them cover one or two communities, and several of them cover several counties. And so they work with those departments, and it's key to work with them ahead of time so you know each other, you understand each other's systems, you understand how things work before, God forbid, there's actually a situation where you need to work together. You want to make sure that all the questions have been answered long before you're out on the fire situation.
Yeah, and I know the legislature, too, is a part of that process. And you guys did a lot of work in creating some really good relationships over the years. You guys have and got 490 across. Ryan Hall, once again, with us from Mecca. It is MT Co-ops. There's a dash between coandops.com for more information. You know, I know that we're only going to just barely kind of graze this topic. A lot of people have been talking about it quite a bit here. You came back, we chatted from a tour of at least one data center. Maybe there was more. Would you please, Ryan, give us your top thoughts again from that professional side here? How our electric co-ops are receiving this information, processing, and what kind of decisions that they'll have to make going forward as AI and data centers go forward.
Right. Well, and I went out to Quincy, Washington, where there are 9 data centers right outside of a town of 7,500. And I got to tour one that's owned by Sabey out there and learned a lot about them. And way more than we have time to talk about quickly. I know we're going to get back on soon.
Yeah.
But also Rural Montana Magazine, which people can read online if you don't get it. If you do get your power from a co-op, you get it. We're working on a 5-part series that's going to really dive into this, Tom. We're going to talk about what is a data center, because that's become a buzzword. And I think it means different things to different people. We're going to talk about the community impact of these things. We're going to talk about concerns people have. We're going to talk about how to power these things and then the prospects for them coming to Montana. What size might come? Where might they locate besides the one we already know are proposed? What co-ops can and can't handle these things? All of those type of things. So it's going to start in July and go through the fall. And I think we'll probably talk several times throughout that. But there's a lot of information on these things. And I can tell you, my tour, I learned a lot more. I thought data centers was one thing and it involved AI. And I learned that the data center term covers so many different things that we really got to dive into all the things that can be called a data center.
Yeah, you know, and I know that there are some challenges that rise a little higher than others, but really they all seem to be, at a certain level of importance as we process and move data centers forward. Do you guys, I'm looking forward to that series as well, and we're going to learn an awful lot. Are you facing some questions right now? Are you facing requests? And that may be an individual cooperative kind of question as well. But, how prevalent, pertinent is it to you right now?
It's incredibly pertinent to us. We're paying a lot of attention. Last I knew, there weren't a ton of requests in co-op country, mm-hmm. but we expect them to come. We expect there to be some interest because of what these things require. They require power. They require a lot of land space. You're going to be talking more rural areas in a lot of cases. I know they've looked outside cities like Great Falls, but that's why Quincy, Washington was one of the ideal places, was they had open land that was available. That's a key thing. These things aren't small. I can tell you that. When I drove on the campus, I felt like driving on a college campus. They have 5 buildings that were all part of this data center. So we expect it to come. We've had a few tire kickers and a few co-ops. We expect the interest. And then our members are very concerned because they're hearing it elsewhere and they want to know, is it coming? Is it going to impact our rates? Is it going to impact our availability to power? What impact is it going to have on the community? So we're getting a lot of questions from members, even if we're not getting them from the data centers themselves quite yet.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing more. And I know you're going to come back with your executive director, Mark Lambrecht, here, who's, like you say, you guys are really, really busy getting informed and working these collaborations. So that'll be up in a couple of weeks too, Ryan. So we'll let it go at that. It's good to hear from you. You have a safe summer as well. Good luck. Why don't you brag a little bit? You have one child who's going to be playing soccer internationally.
I appreciate that. My middle son, Bladen, was selected for a team last year, a national team, and played in Brazil. And this year we're going to Argentina. So 3 days after the World Cup, he gets to play in Lionel Messi Stadium in Argentina. So that's going to be a big step for him and a lot of excitement for Montana kids. We have not just him. We have a total of, I think, 12 Montana kids going to Brazil and Argentina this year to play soccer. So they're really starting to put Montana on the map.
That's pretty cool. We have a couple of teachers in studio, and we're doing a little bit of externship here. And Miss Sisson is just clapping, and so is Miss Potter as well, when you talk about kids going international like that. So we're going to take a break and come on back. They have been frowning a lot. Like, I get that. And that made me feel right at home, as a matter of fact. No, just kidding. We're going to come back and chat with them just a little bit about what it's like to be a teacher nowadays. So anyway, congratulations to you and the youngster and the family. Good luck, and we'll talk to you down the road a bit.
Thank you for the time.
All right, Ryan Hall once again with Mecca. Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.